wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion. This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zef.
I'm Eric.
Not together in our studio. We're in back in separate places thanks to the rising number of cases of the death plague.
And the total absence of time for me as well.
Yes, that too. But we are going to be together whenever we get around to doing the Van Halen show that we've been talking about, because obviously right. Eddie Van Halen passed the other week, and I know you are ready to give us an understanding of 80s rock.
No, that's the point. I'm not ready. If I was ready, we'd be doing it now.
Okay.
But I'm
Well,
not
you
ready.
Will be ready.
But I will be ready.
You will be ready.
Yeah.
You will be ready. So instead, we have a regular show of bits and bobs that we're going to weave through. But obviously, because we are back in separate places because of the rise in numbers of death plague, it means that we've been probably watching too much TV.
This is true. Am I talking? Okay, so that we did have a meteor story, I should mention, that came from a senior scientist of the pod.
I completely destroyed that segue. I got it all wrong. I skipped the wrong direction.
Yeah, so, sorry. As you know, we're often warning people off. This is a video that shows a meteoroid skipping off of Earth's atmosphere. In other words, you know, we tend to think they're going to come through, but in this one, it came close enough that it basically, when you look in the sky, it kind of arced up. The video is, I think, augmented, so it shows like a streak of what it is. It wouldn't have looked quite as bold as that, but it definitely shows like it's dipping into the sky and going back up the other direction instead of just sort of falling or even just passing straight through. And basically it skips off the atmosphere the way like a stone does when you throw it down on a lake, you know, or a pond with the sidearm motion. Yeah. With the flat stone, it goes bang, bang, bang off the top, which kind of makes sense. I don't know if it was flat, but it bounced off of there. And they say scientists estimate Earth grazing meteoroids occur only just a handful of times per year, blah, 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 all this stuff. But no estimate of size on this, but likely fairly small. So this was not one of our ones that we'd be warning everybody off, but, you know, just to know.
Still, the atmosphere is designed for this specific purpose. Let me take that back.
Yeah.
The atmosphere actually does act as a shield. I think we always keep it. I always think of it as sort of this sort of invisible like garden wall that keeps us in and keeps other things out.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably not a bad way to think about it.
I mean, it keeps us in the sense that you can't breathe if you go past it, you mean?
Yeah. And we have that. Like we've had that space discussion.
Yeah, like, well, because that barrier is like a conditions barrier, whereas the barrier for things coming in, which includes ultraviolet light and, you know, things like that from the ozone blocking and all those, there's all these properties that keep it on there. And that's more of a physical barrier, right? Like
right.
As opposed to like a operational barrier. I think that's right. I think it's funny that you said it's designed to. Suddenly we went into the, you know, some sort of biblical things. I'm not saying that's not true, but what scientists would say is the existence of it is what it made possible for us to still be here.
Yes, because the moon doesn't have any atmosphere, which is why the moon, to keep it on meteors and asteroids and things attacking us, the moon has been battered by stuff flying through space.
Sure.
Like it just takes a direct hit.
Takes a beating.
Yeah, whereas, you know, Earth has this atmospheric barrier that sort of frizzles stuff up. And you're right. I think we tend to forget, too. It also protects us from, you know, sort of harmful radiation that would zap us in an instant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, thanks, atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's working. I mean, I don't trust it entirely, but still.
Yeah. Well, if we keep abusing it, then maybe it'll be like, all right, enough of you guys. Not hooking you up anymore. I'm not your bodyguard. Anyway, the asteroid thing, just before we're getting on, we were going to skip it just because, the meteoroid, we were going to skip it just because we cover that more than enough. But I did want to mention that I recently found myself staying up too late. You know, you start a movie and it's 11:30 or 11 o'clock. I'm not even start a movie. You stumble into a movie because you're switching around channels. And suddenly you find yourself and you're like, shoot, when does this movie end? Because I want to finish it to the end, but I don't know how it's going to go. And this was Deep Impact. Deep Impact, we've spoken about before, is one of these. There was a pairing of movies. You had Deep Impact and Armageddon.
That's right.
rough. I can't remember. It was the same year, if it was nearby.
1998, I think.
Was if Deep I'm Impact. Correct. When was Armageddon?
It was later that summer.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So Deep Impact was the one with Robert Duvall, Tia Leone, Elijah Wood, Vanessa Redgrave, Morgan Freeman, John Favreau. I mean, it was pretty heavy duty cast.
Yes.
Richard Schiff. I mean, this is no small cast thing. It is, you know, like a bunch of those atrocious. I mean, the movie is just goofy as all get out.
Is it atrocious, you know, or is it?
They take a spaceship up there, and it's like a customized version of the space shuttle.
Yeah.
And they're going to knock out this, asteroid comet. It's a comet that's coming, and they gotta, you know, maneuver around there and try to blow it up, and it doesn't really work out. But that was really the part. This is what got me stuck.
Is it goofy or is it bad? See, I find it goofy. I don't think it's a bad movie. It's very slow and sort of self-serious. It's not so much a bad movie. It's just not a very exciting movie. I don't think it's a goofy movie. Whereas, okay, so by that standard, see, I think Armageddon is a goofy movie.
Yeah, Armageddon's goofy.
Right, okay. Sure. I think Deep Impact is definitely not goofy. It's just not very exciting.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in fact, I'd like to think that if Earth was about to be attacked by meteor, asteroid, or comet, frankly, I think it'd all be a bit more exciting.
Well, so, I mean, this is where I got caught up in it, because I don't care that I'm going to give away the plot, but if you really are worried about it, skip ahead 2 minutes. They don't really succeed. They break the comet into two parts.
Right.
At which point, Morgan Freeman gets on the air and tells everybody, "Not bad. We're going to take another shot at it with some nukes." Turns out that doesn't work either. So they say the small piece. There's two, the bigger piece, the small piece is going to land in the Atlantic, and it's going to create this crazy tidal wave.
Right.
And then the large piece is like supposed to end life on Earth. And they do manage to, like, unbeknownst to them, the spaceship's still hanging around and actually manages to get the big piece, but it doesn't fix the small piece. In fact, you know, the way it balances, you don't really know everything's going to happen. But of course, obviously, it's not going to totally destroy the Earth. But when I realized the small piece was going to land, or remembered, I mean, I'd seen it before.
Okay.
I'm simply hanging around watching this to see what the special effects are going to be of this tidal wave, because I couldn't remember like how it works out. And I'm like, okay, I had to plod through another half hour of the movie just going through the paces going, listen, I just want to see what the wave looks like when it goes and washes across, and it's supposed to go 400 miles inshore and stuff like that. So it was a classic case of the movie's not that interesting, but I'm waiting for the interesting part. And it was fine, but it really wasn't worth me staying up late.
Well, because you make an interesting point about those sort of like cataclysmic disaster movies. If you're going to tout something in the notion of Deep Impact, Earth is going to get pounded by a large rock, asteroid, mm-hmm. comet, meteor from outer space. You have to tread this fine line between having everyone be saved, but also smashing the place up a little bit. Otherwise, yeah. There's no sort of intermediate. Do you know what I mean? Like I was suddenly thinking about, because these are ultimately all disaster movies. I was suddenly thinking about there's good disaster movies and there's bad disaster movies. And I was trying to think if there was some golden rule about how to tell the story, but there isn't. So, for example, Poseidon Adventure, the big cataclysmic disaster happens at the start of the movie.
Well, I was about to say, I think if you had a rule for it, it should be, and it's what's the one where the Earth gets all frozen up real quickly?
The Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah, that happens at the beginning, and the rest of it is like dealing with this stuff. So, like, if you save the real disaster part for the very end, I don't know. That's not really a disaster movie, is it?
Well, that's the thing, though, isn't it? I mean, like, Taron Inferno, which is another one of the great disaster movies. Like, it's got a disaster which you know is slowly getting worse. And that's where the suspense comes, that this disaster is growing. Have you ever seen that 70s movie Earthquake with Charlton Heston? Sure I have, but, you know. So in Earthquake, the big quake happens kind of in the middle of the movie. And then it's all about sort of, I don't know, it's weird. Like, you can...
Well, and then rock one, the Dwayne Johnson thing. Where,
there you go.
Like,
that happens right at the start, doesn't it?
That was all going on, like, during it. I think there were a couple of stages, if I remember right. But, you know, they're having to deal with, like, having it all at the end. It's just a suspense movie.
Yeah, I guess there's doom, impending doom, and that's just not going to happen at all.
And the point of the reason a real disaster movie is interesting is because you put a bunch of people into settings that don't exist.
Right.
Well, in this one, I mean, other than the fact they're in the spaceship made out of spare parts, there isn't really like. It's just people like broadcasting on the news, being worried, making plans, who's doing this, who knew what. But it's a lot of stuff to get to the blow up payoff. And of course, you knew, even if you didn't see the movie, you knew it wasn't going to like, you weren't going to have the Earth ending version unless it was really going to be a depressing ending. And you would have probably picked that up in the review.
I don't want to, I want to pick up on something you mentioned earlier there about the movie that they send up some astronauts in like a goofy space shuttle knockoff. Mm-hmm. I have found. So I watched a couple of weeks ago, I watched on Netflix the four-part documentary of the Challenger disaster, which was very well done, produced by, executive produced, I think, by your man, J.J. Abrahams. It was very well done.
J.J. Abrams.
There you go. Four 40-minute episodes that basically just sort of retold the story with lots of interviews from, you know, different people who worked on the program and a lot of very interesting footage.
And that's on Netflix?
Yeah, not on Netflix. Okay. I think it's just called Challenger, and it's like four 45-minute episodes. It's very well done. And I found the interesting thing is just about the space shuttle. The space shuttle is an idea. It's something that, frankly, like fiction has got so much more mileage out of the space shuttle than we ever got as mankind, because it doesn't even fly anymore. We just bung stuff up there. And sort of hope that, do you know what I mean? On rockets or Richard Branson or Tesla.
But listen, you know, fiction's gotten more things out of every mode of transportation
in real life.
I mean, like the Keanu Reeves movie about the bus. Buses were never that exciting.
Well, no, you're
speed,
right. Yes,
that's what it was.
Speed, yeah. So, all right. So the Deep Impact.
Yep.
Did you not at any moment go, I'm just going to TiVo this and watch it later? Because I have done that, but I feel weird doing that.
You check and you go, well, there's 20 minutes left, you know. I watched Jojo Rabbit the other day, but I stumbled into it partway in, and then I realized, I was like, oh, this is actually a good movie. And so then I recorded it and watched the front end of it, but it didn't really interfere with my enjoyment of it.
Yeah, I find like bad movies that end up on basic cable with commercials, I almost feel like, but it's right, there's something slightly addictive about finding something like that late at night. And you're sitting there and you're thinking, you know, I don't really want to be up until 1:15. But then you do sort of reach this moment that you're sort of you are suddenly plot committed in the you do have to. Well,
it wouldn't be nearly as interesting. Like I'm not actually going to come back and probably watch that.
That's the thing.
There.
Yes.
so it's only because you're in there and it's whatever. It's like work.
Yes.
It's like a hobby, not work. If it was work, then I wouldn't want to do it at all. But if it's something where you're like, oh, I'll feel like a sense of accomplishment when I finish this.
And it is great on basic cable. I don't know if this... I can imagine that Deep Impact... Because Deep Impact now is over 20-year-old movie, it's probably not the sort of movie where they're playing it back-to-back. But I have done that where you watch the last...
Oh, right.
Watch the last 45 minutes and then you just go back and watch the first half.
No commercial. If this had been commercials, I think the commercials would have led me to be like, what am I staying here for? There's no point.
Oh, that was on a channel where there were no commercials. That movie's been played in its entirety somewhere?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh.
I think there was, they seemed to be, because the same channel when I turned it on the next day was doing Armageddon. I assume it, I don't know if that's their version of Halloween movies. I don't know. It definitely seemed like they were pushing cataclysmic movies, or maybe
cataclysmic
they just know,
week. Well, Skyscraper.
They just know the election that's coming up.
I think Skyscraper's been playing on TNT or FX. And that's, you mentioned The Rock. That's The Rock movie where he's in a skyscraper, and it's basically like he's a security guard.
Right, he's a helicopter pilot. I thought he like.
No, that's the earthquake movie. This one's called Skyscraper, and he's in it.
Oh yeah, right. I haven't seen that one.
He's a security guard, and his family live in the skyscraper, and there's a fire, but there's also terrorists. So it is basically like, ooh. Why don't we take Die Hard and Taron Inferno, throw them into the one movie, and then just throw in The Rock?
See, that's what they didn't like, because they said Die Hard wasn't a disaster movie because only the blow-ups only happen at the end. So if you put them earlier in the process, it makes it a disaster movie.
That's true. Die Hard, but Die Hard is an action movie, which is a very different thing altogether.
Altogether.
Though I'm talking of movies, I sat the other night and watched the Borat sequel, which is called... Let me actually.
It's like a subsequent movie or something like
yes.
that.
Yes. And it was interesting, but Borat subsequent movie film. Now, I'd seen the first one in the cinema, loved it. I think he is extremely talented, very clever. I've not seen so much of his recent stuff because I think I agree with some of the sort of criticism. No, criticism is the wrong word. It gets tougher to do his shtick because you can't keep catching people out.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Like, he has to invent a new character because people recognize the old character. So anyway, this thing was a sequel and it was released on Amazon Prime. So I actually, and I can't decide. So this is the point I wanted to make. So I sat and watched it on Amazon Prime. Now, to be fair, it is not, you know, we've been talking about action movies and rock movies and Deep Impact, and those are the sort of spectacle movies you need to see on a big screen. But I couldn't decide in watching Borat on Amazon Prime, like I had this weird, like, is this just a pumped up TV show or is this a movie? Now, to be fair, the original movie, you know, it's not spectacle, but it was weird. It suddenly felt different watching it on TV.
That's another one, though. You might sit through the whole thing only to see the payoff of, like, was Rudy Giuliani really doing something horrible, or is it just a big misunderstanding? I mean, don't ruin it for anybody. You want to make everybody go through the same process.
No, I thought you were asking me the question.
Saying you might, like, because everybody knows, or for people who have seen in the news about this, it is like one of the later scenes, I understand.
It is the climax to the movie.
So there might be a decent number of people who tune in just being like, well, when is that scene going to come up? And they'll sit through the whole thing to get there.
It is the big finish.
Yeah.
The movie's interesting in the, I don't want to go too deep into it. It's 95 minutes. It goes down quick.
It's only too deep. It's only so deep you can go.
It ebbs and flows. Like, there are some moments that it's this interesting thing. There are some moments of, like, just pure, like you know, him catching people out, and did you know, in that sort of way where it's like, oh yeah, there is the big finish with Giuliani. I don't know. So my point was, I watched it on Amazon Prime, which I already pay for, and I thought it was very entertaining, and I am predisposed to liking what he does. But there was a part of me when it finished where I'm suddenly thinking, how would I feel if I'd paid $14 and gone down the cinema to watch?
Oh yeah, no, you wouldn't do that.
Well, and that's the thing, because I went to see the first one, and the first one was side-splittingly funny. Like, I laughed myself senseless. I still think it's just beyond genius, the first movie. The second one is not as good as the first one, and I'm using that very trite way of sort of giving something value. It's not as good as the first one, but its peaks are as high as the first one. There just aren't as many of them.
Right.
But it was this interesting thing, like, and I think because of the death plague that we are all, that is coming back again, I had no idea it was coming out until I saw it advertised earlier in the week. And I saw some websites talking about it, and I clicked on the trailer, and I'm like, oh wow, there's a Borat movie coming. And my point was that if we were in normal sort of circumstances, we would have known about this for 6 weeks. So I felt like almost he caught me out in classic.
Yeah, well, or the other way is the reason why it probably wasn't as notable is because you're not being caught out as much. So therefore, you know, whatever. You know, like, you kind of know what his bits going to be. You don't know what the bits are going to be, but you know overall what the approach is.
Yeah. So anyway, that was a new release movie that I watched on Amazon Prime, the Borat movie. Talking of cinema and, of course, Dead People, which is a sort of a theme of our show.
Where yeah, there's never a shortage.
Never a shortage of dead people. And we did the aforementioned Van Halen that we will be coming to. Someone called Margaret Nolan passed away last week. And I've said the name, and people are like, what the hell are these guys talking about? But if you like James Bond movies, she was the girl who was painted gold, not in the movie, but in the credits of the movie.
Right. That's the part that first threw me off is when you sent the link, and I'm looking at it and I'm thinking of the person who ends up dead all painted gold in the movie. And I'm like, that doesn't look like that person. And it wasn't until I got partway through and sort of read it a second time. I said, oh, I see. It's she did the dance, the stuff. What I mean, the obviously the song was Goldfinger. Who sang Goldfinger?
Shirley Bassey.
It's really bad. So like, you know, like a bang, you know, like the whole, so ended the dance. It was the long intro thing. Not very in fashion to have a long intro on your movies nowadays, but they keep it up. So that made more sense once I realized that. But she actually appeared in the movie, didn't she? As some other character totally unrelated, right?
Yes, she was his masseuse, and her character's name was Dink.
Dink, I don't know if you want to tell the story of her. You know, it looks like she was a model and whatever. But it's also, you know, she became an actor, and I think she even acted. Was gone for a while and then did some acting fairly recently, didn't she?
Yeah, I mean, she'd sort of knocked around. But again, the reason I think she's notable, and I'm going to mention a couple of other things she did, which I think are an interesting part of the discussion. But obviously that, you know, Goldfinger was the biggest Bond when it came out. It was the biggest film of the year. It was the equivalent of, you know, Star Wars, whatever the biggest, do you know what I mean? Like, it was a monster movie. And obviously, you know, this actress was part of this iconic image from the film that was on all the that was on all the posters and all this type of thing.
Sure.
And you know, she was, to your point, I think someone said somewhere she was she began her career in the arts as a glamour model. So she was just the model, and they filmed this. So if you haven't seen the credit sequence, obviously it's this sort of this girl who's been painted gold, and sort of the, you know, the credits are sort of shined across her body. And it's very kind of stylish,
and shots and all that jazz.
Very stylish, and it sort of had me to thinking that the 60s were this era where not just the James Bond movies, but credits were sort of a thing of their own. Like if you watch any Alfred Hitchcock movie from the 60s. There's all kinds of cool credit sequences, like just different ways of throwing you the words. You know, I remember. Well, no, but what I mean is like.
No, I mean, that's like that'd be the big CGI version of it. Nowadays, you know, like maybe it's too easy. And so what are you going to do?
They just put the words up.
Yeah.
Starring so-and-so. Like, have you ever seen, you know, the old Pink Panther movies with Peter Sellers? Like the credits were always part of a sort of Pink Panther cartoon. So you would sit and watch stuff going on. Do you know what I mean?
And it's double feature.
Yeah. I just find like it's sort of maybe a lost art is going a bit far, but it doesn't seem to happen as much now where people do like cool credits that sort of get you into the movie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But she was also, she did do some acting, and I hadn't realized until I was reading her obituary, she also was in A Hard Day's Night, which I think was the same year or a couple of years after Goldfinger. And of course, A Hard Day's Night was the big Beatles movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I was going to say, you're going to have to explain a little bit to it. I'm sure I've seen chunks of it, but it's a fictional story involving the Beatles. I can't remember.
Well, no, so.
Or is it like a movie? Is it like a concert movie kind of thing?
Well, this is the thing, and this was the thing I thought interesting about me. So Hard Day's Night is a movie with the Beatles in it and actors playing characters, like, you know, one their granddad and all kinds of stuff. And so it is sort of like a fictional story of the Beatles on their way to London to record their album and play concerts. So there is plots and stories, and, you know, one of them gets, you know, Ringo Starr gets lost and separated from the band, and, you know, all kinds of other stuff going on. And yet, you know, they also have moments where they stop and play songs.
Right.
Like this. So it's
a musical comedy.
Yeah.
And
I mean, basically, if you've seen the Monkees TV show, well, that's where the Monkees TV show got its idea from, was from A Hard Day's Night. And it's in black and white. Like there's an early scene where they're running to make the train to London, and they're on the train to London.
I'm reading from the Wikipedia. The Beatles evade a horde of fans while boarding a train for London. En route, they meet Paul's troublemaking grandfather for the first time.
Paul's grandfather. That's right.
Such a nuisance that Paul has him locked up in the guard's van. But soon, they join inside. They play cards and entertain some schoolgirls before arriving at the London station. Blah blah blah. All this stuff.
Well, but that's the thing. When they're in the guard's van, suddenly instruments appear and they play Ticket to Ride.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So it's this weird, so it's like slightly surreal, but it does, like I said, it was in black and white. And so it's also sort of,
I mean, all musicals are at some level surreal, right? Because
yeah, I guess you're right. So maybe I'm thinking too hard about it.
Yeah.
I think because
it's when we see it in a movie is when, like, it's fine. You go to a theater, it's a theater's live people. So when they start doing songs, you just sort of expect it. But when you see in a movie, you're like, oh, this is weird. But, you know, it's the blending. It was sort of like a Curb Your Enthusiasm matched with main real characters and then mixed around a bunch of fake characters.
Well, so you mentioned musicals, but most musicals, when you see them on in the cinema, are actors doing the singing. Right, like if you see Les Miserables
or a band, right? You know,
but this was,
if your characters are a band, is that actually different? You know,
well, that's the thing. So to me, the interesting thing is this is what happens when a band acts, which is slightly different from an actor who's already a performer singing, right? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And yet, ultimately, when you watch it, I couldn't. It's one of those things. How much
the uncredited people in it, looking at Wikipedia, is Phil Collins as a schoolboy watching the Beatles, and then Charlotte Rampling, who we discussed just a couple of episodes ago from being in the Zardoz movie with Sean Connery.
So, yeah, and the Beatles sort of play this stylized version of themselves, but because of who they were at the time, it was very easy, even now when you watch it. And it's only like an hour and 45 minutes long. A song comes every 7 to 8 minutes. Some of the songs are played over action. Do you know what I mean? Like they are like the soundtrack. And then there are other moments sort of out of concert where they break into song. But the Beatles did sort of play this kind of slightly stylized version of themselves where you watch it and you think, well, maybe they are kind of like that. Do you know what I mean? And again, I mentioned the Monkees, which was clearly inspired by A Hard Day's Night. The Beatles did this, and then they did another one called Help, which again they did the movie and the album, and the two things were tied together. And you know they were printing money, so to speak, because that's what the Beatles did during the 60s. But I did find it interesting. I don't know. I feel like it's an idea that has sort of died its. I don't know.
I think they've had some movies from pop stars these days, but not like you're paying any attention, nor would we have those in our summer reviews. So,
I mean, the Spice Girls, who we talked about a couple of Christmases ago, they basically ripped off A Hard Day's Night. It's basically the same. It's the same movie. It's just got the Spice Girls in it. But I'm trying to remember, like, you remember the Bee Gees? The Bee Gees did.
Yeah, they did one.
What was it called? And here was the interesting thing about the one the Bee Gees did. Was it...
Bee Gees.
The Bee Gees, Bee Gees. that's going in the best of. The Bee Gees did one, but they co-opted the Sergeant Pepper character.
That's true. That's right.
And that's what makes that... Now, I've never seen that film, but that's what makes it kind of interesting, that they have co-opted characters by the Beatles.
I don't know if they... I think it was part of the arrangement. I don't think they stole them.
No, but okay. No, I don't mean it that way. But what I mean is it's interesting that the Bee Gees did a movie and they're featuring characters by another band, which I thought was sort of interesting. But I'm trying to think.
Back to being Margaret Nolan. What was she in this movie? She's just a person.
She was just in it. She did some acting. But like I say, when I did, and she was also in a series of British comedies that were famous from that time called Carry On films that would be released like, you know, twice a year.
It says Carry On franchise.
The Carry On franchise, which is about 15 films. And what's interesting about the Carry On franchise is it features about 25 different actors, none of whom appear in all of them, but all of whom appear in some of them. So it was not a franchise built around an actor or a character or a series of characters. It was built, you know, it is very goofy, slapstick, you know, for its time, slightly bawdy, I think is the word that gets
used. Well, I say, like, she was Miss Jones in Carry On Cowboy, and she was, quote, Buxom Lass in Carry On Henry VIII, and Popsy in Carry On at Your Convenience, as well as Carry On Matron. And then she was in Carry On Girls as Dawn Breaks.
And so the Carry On films had like the staple of about 25 different actors that all would show up in them. And anytime you'd see any of them, you would know that this is a legit Carry On film. And it's very, and you know, it's funny. I haven't seen any, when I was a kid, those movies were on all the time. Cause there must've been about 17, 18, 19 of them that all got made within like 6 or 7 years. Some are way
31 Carry On films.
31. There you go. I sold it
in 1992.
Some are way funnier than others.
Sure.
The ones that are funny, though, you can sit and watch them. And if you're in the mood for that kind of, I guess it's the equivalent, gross out humor is the wrong phrase. But if you're in the mood for that sort of thing, some of them are very funny. And to be fair, while it seemed like it was all kind of throwaway, you do appreciate in the good ones, like the art form to comedy. And what I mean is, I think it's no different now. You can go and see like a Vince Vaughn and what's his name? Oh, the two of them who are in Wedding Crashers. All that gang.
Owen Wilson.
Like Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson movies are all kind of the same movies, but there are good ones, and then there are ones that are really dumb.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like
the one where they played interns or whatever it was.
Yeah. But then, like, so there is this massive gap between the intern movie and Wedding Crashers. Do you know what I mean? With like old school somewhere in there and Starsky and Hutch. And yeah. So anyway, she was in the Carry On films. So yeah, I just found it interesting because obviously growing up in England, when she died, there was this sort of outpouring of tweets from different people my age and younger who'd grown up seeing her in things. So, you know, the
and she worth mentioning, like, she didn't look like I was thinking. She's obviously attractive, but she has a look that maybe would not sell as like modern day attractive, just a sort of a rounder face. And, you know,
it's funny when you say that. I'll tell you what we'll try and do. I'll try and stick a picture on the blog. So if you can't be bothered to look yourself, you can just look at that picture. Yeah, there is. It's interesting. I think it was just a different time.
Right. Although I will say, like, I think there's a lot of that that's changed over the past 10 years or something like that, where there's more interesting looking people, actresses and things like that, that would be considered attractive. But it would, like, you know, when you think of 60s, 70s kind of stuff, it's a little different, you know, so whatever.
But the fact that she was in A Hard Day's Night just led me to wonder. I was just trying to think if any other, I suddenly sat there and I think quite a few bands had done movies. You know, like The Who were behind Quadrophenia, but it is very much a film where they are the soundtrack. And I think the Rolling Stones did a concert movie, but I don't think anyone sort of did this kind of surreal, almost sort of MTV-ish type. You know, it's if you go back and watch A Hard Day's Night, it is amazing, considering it's 1964 or 65 and black and white. You do see it as sort of like the foundation.
Well, you know, it says, I mean, it's listed on, like, you know, we make it, I'm sure for a lot of people, it sounds like this is some junk money grab,
no.
but it's listed in a lot of movie reviews as like great movies over the period, maybe not necessarily for the acting reasons, but because of what it represented and a new idea kind of thing.
The director went on to direct the original Superman movie.
It's not a plus in my books.
Okay. All right. I guess that's where you're going to go. I definitely think, you know, so when this Margaret Nolan passed away, she was an iconic character in James Bond, which is the first of the big blockbuster franchises. And then she was also in A Hard Day's Night, which as an art piece is sort of a seminal is the wrong word, but it's sort of this interesting sort of touchstone, you know, featuring, you know, the biggest band of all time. So I just thought it was interesting when she passed away. I'm like, oh, there you go. It was just interesting her career suddenly linked to these two different things.
Yeah, she was 76.
76, so yeah. All right, next story. Where do you want to go next?
So it's more senior scientist stuff. The last two stories are kind of linked, so I'll cover this one quickly. The senior scientist of the pod, having listened to our cheese podcast, sent us a link to Board Panda, 30 unusual maps that people shared on this group that might change your perspective on things. And one of them is a map of Europe with all their biggest cheeses. or their most important cheeses, I guess. And I'm trying, the font is pretty small on here, but I mean, it's pretty specific. There's a lot of, you do see cheddar and Stilton over in Great Britain, and more cheddar up in Northern Scotland, more cheddar in Ireland. But then, you know, some other places, you've got your Manchego over in Spain and Asiago in northern Italy, Parmesan in sort of northern Italy. And when you get down to Sicily, you get your Pecorino. Didn't we have a Pecorino? I can't remember.
I don't think we did, no. And I still have those bits of paper lying around
so, here. A bunch of cheeses there. But so, ironically, it wasn't the most interesting part of the map. It's like there was a map that was the GPS tracking of wolves in six different packs and yes. somewhere in the National Park Service. And these wolves are like barely touch each other's area. Like, you know, they're covering all this ground, like dense is all different colors for each one of the packs. And they're all very densely covering their area, but then almost hardly any overlap. So you can kind of see how the animals kind of avoid each other. There's one about like the 20-year life of a eagle and its flight pass over
that
20
was fascinating.
Years from all the way down, like in Sudan up to, basically Kazakhstan.
Where yeah. Borat comes from.
Exactly. Yeah. How big Japan is, you know, all the maps, people talk about the projection of maps being northern hemisphere specific because they're like the way it's all twisted. And people tend to think of Japan as a smallish nation.
But
at least in length, it's as long as like basically eastern seaboard of the United States. And so, it's not by no tiny, it's not tiny or anything.
No, it's big. Because those bullet trains have to get up to speed. I want to say this for senior science advisor of the pod. When he sent this, I'm like, how are we going to talk about maps? And then I clicked on the link.
And I mean, sent a link. I think people get a kick out of it.
Yeah, but I got to tell you something. And I think that's my point. When I clicked on, I ended up in this deep dive where I went off on all these tangents. So, you know, the Japanese one, I thought the eagle one was fascinating. The Japanese one was fascinating. Then there is another one which is a map of the world where New Zealand is its center. And it was only at that moment and I had this weird and I'm now gonna probably get hammered back in England for this, back in Great Britain for this. When you grow up in Britain, it is true at a basic subconscious psychological level, you think you are the middle of the world. Because every map has Greenwich Mean Time as its spine. And of course that runs right through London. So it's interesting to see a map of the world where Britain is just some weird offshoot of it. And so I suddenly had this realization that why our national psyche still wants us to think that somehow we are the most important part of the world. So there was that one, the cheese map, obviously.
Like they had a Canada one which said that like 50% of the Canadians live below this line, and it's like way down at the bottom. It's this tiny little.
That one
like
was unbelievable.
5% of the landmass of Canada.
Yes.
And half of the country lives under it, kind of thing.
Other ones I thought were interesting, the longest possible train travel in the world. There was also another one that I thought was quite interesting. So many of them are interesting. And I don't know.
Yeah, the one I like, this topologist map of the world. And so it's basically, instead of the countries looking like actual countries, you create a circle and you just make diagrams in such a way so that each country is touching the parts that are countries that it touches. And then the like bodies of water are like little separations. And it's like, I don't know what the heck it tells you, but just interesting that somebody would have gone through this process of, okay, I can make this way. And, you know, Zambia will be touching Mozambique and Congo, but not, you know, South Africa, and like having them all diagrammed up. And then all the places that are islands, like circle the big circle, because they're all countries that have no borders with anybody, but they put them roughly close to the places that they're across bodies of water, but the bodies of water are very, it's almost, think of it like a subway map, you know, or the tube map, where it's not a real representation of the places. It's a way of like looking at it and getting information about what joins to where and how you can get from one place to another place on land mass or where you'd have to cross water without actually being in the right geographic places.
It is interesting. You talk about maps that are schematics, and we always talk about subway maps being that way. And it is interesting to see how different countries and different cities decide to sort of do their their subway map. I actually have a map of the London Underground hanging up on my wall in the studios here by the river, just because back in England that is an iconic sort of diagram of colors and shapes and lines.
And that one's changed over time. I remember when we went to, I think we went to some museum about it over there. Like in the past, it was a much more like a regular map with lots of swoops and things. And somewhere along the line, mostly in the 50s and 60s, people realized you could convey the information to people better. But like the Metro map in DC has always been like a basic set of graphics. You know, like you can tell things are roughly in the place they're going to be, but they don't bother trying to make the right distances. It's really to tell you, hey, if you get on this train, if you make a switch over on this line, then you'll end up in this place and you can go where you want to go.
Whereas the London Underground map, it would be, is entirely useless in terms of trying to looking at it and attempting to correlate anything that might help you if you were not using the tube. Like there are stations that look like they're really close to each other, and then in real life they're like 3 miles apart. So it's just an interesting way. I want to shout out one more map that I found really interesting too, was the map of Europe, and it had they had all the pedestrian logos from crossing lights on each country and how they are all different. And there's one in Poland where the pedestrian is just a silhouette of a dude, almost like the men's room. Like he's not walking, whereas all the other ones are in the act of walking. I thought that one was kind of interesting.
Well, so, I don't know if you read the comments that follow, but like somebody commented, because it appeared that once they had the Polish person in the middle, they had anybody on the right side of Poland walking to the right and everybody on the left side of Poland walking to the left.
Right.
And so it looked as if everybody was avoiding Poland. I think the joke was that maybe Poland farted or something.
Yes. And it was interesting too. When I was going through the link and looking at all the different maps, I just happened to do it at the same time as I had a couple of other websites open, and there was a story on the CNN website that McDonald's were uploading maps that were based, like, in, for example, in like the New York metro area, where the information on the maps were McDonald's where the ice cream machine is not working. And so you could look at this map and figure out where you could go if you wanted to ensure that your McDonald's had ice cream. But McDonald's had taken the time to post this information. I just thought that was kind of ironic. That we will obviously link that, and it's from the website to Bored Panda. Talking of bears, we've got a double bear story.
Which reminds me of when Steve Colbert used to have all his warning on the old show on Comedy Central, is like be afraid of bears kind of thing.
Well, I'm going to start with the one that I added in, and it's not a very interesting story. It just had one line in it which caught my attention. So this one was from The Guardian just this weekend. It was called Ursine Terror, Plea to Improve Habitat After Spate of Bear Attacks in Japan. So any of these built-up areas, there is clearly a clash now, and it happens around here near the New Basin Studio, where, you know, because the line between city and country is now ill-defined, bears end up wandering into human areas, you know, to get food, and then obviously there are conflicts there. Here's the interesting thing, and I now need to find the line that caught my attention, and I just read it and I'm like, yeah, no, I don't think that's the case. Let me see here. Experts, bear injures man.
It's acorns related. They had an acorn shortage.
They eat acorns, but somewhere within the story, I can't find it now. There is the line somewhere within the story. This is driving me nuts because I just clicked on the story and now I can't find it.
About the revived memories of Japan's deadliest bear attack, the Sangibetsu incident, in which a 750-pound bear killed 7 villagers in 1915.
Oh, wow. It
inspired novels, radios, and stage productions.
Well, what it said was that there was a line somewhere that basically said that these interactions, conservationists have warned that encounters between bears and humans, a traumatic experience for both parties. Now, as soon as I read that, I'm laughing. I don't want to demean any of our bear listeners, but if I'm confronted by an 8-foot grizzly bear, I don't think he's being traumatized. I'm the only one being traumatized.
I don't know, but you know, there's members of this household who find the encounter with a spider traumatizing. Yeah. That spider's not going to like kill you. So
yeah, but the spider's not traumatized. My point here, the bear is getting traumatized. You shouldn't be afraid of it.
Like if the bear isn't afraid, the bear may still find it traumatizing.
Okay.
They just don't know how to say eek.
All right. So anyway, there was that story, but then there was the other one which I'd read, and you know,
I can't imagine anybody hasn't heard about this, so we'll just sort of tip our hat to it, which was Bear Week, about the fattest bear.
Well, I'd heard about it until I read all these articles.
No, but it was just, for whatever reason, at least for me this year, I must have gotten emails from, like, senior scientists, from you, from other people, all talking about, like, oh, this is so neat, where they... I forget what group it is, National Park Preserve, or I don't know, but it's all part of a national park item where they have like a playoff of fat bears, where they, and the deal is as these bears approach hibernation, they beef themselves up. And so they show you before and after pictures of the bear. And then they ask people to vote for which bear they like, or whichever bear they think is fattest or whatever. So it's a playoff. I don't know if you voted on anywhere along, but they seem to go online and a lot vote. Of information
yes.
to vote. Like, and I was like, I don't want to get on the list. So I never did vote, but the winner was a salmon chomping Bruin nicknamed 747, like the jumbo jet, as the people's choice of the most fabulously fat.
Let me tell you what's been traumatic is being a bear and ending up in the fat bear playoff. Now, if I'm a bear and I'm in the fat bear playoff, I can understand psychologically being traumatized by being stuck into this competition. Let me put it that way. But you could vote on all these bears. And I think I kind of think the point of the competition, obviously, for most people is to draw attention.
Yeah.
And I want to tie it to all those great maps that senior scientists said us, was to sort of tie it to the notion of, you know, lifestyle and where they're roaming, and obviously they're tracking the bears and what they're eating. And it's just interesting to just sort of, I think it's kind of a neat way to get people engaged in the bear ecosystem.
Yeah,
said there was a week of frenzied online voting in what has become an international sensation, Fat Bear Week. And 747, apparently, the park said of him, this year he really packed on the bounds, looking like he was fat enough to hibernate in July and yet continuing to eat until his belly seemed to drag along the ground by late September.
Yeah, so the it's explore.org is who puts it on. I'm trying to figure out what their live cams. I mean, it's just nature cams and things like that, cameras that people can look at stuff. I guess it's, I assume by the org, it's a nonprofit, but who knows. But when you go there, there's a link at the main article you sent that has the Hall of Fame of Fat Bear Week. And Otis, 480 Otis, is a three-time winner, 2014, 2016, and 2017, but hasn't won the last couple of years. And this is 747's first win. Beadnose is also a double winner. Holly took it in 2019.
A what nose?
Beadnose, that's the name of the... They all have a number and a name that follows it. So you have 480 Otis is a three-time winner. 409 Beadnose, B-E-A-D-N-O-S-E.
Oh, that's two-time his name.
Winner. Yeah.
That's not a brand of Dolph. Of
no, bear. No. These are all
brown bears.
I guess it's all Alaska, so I think they must be grizzlies. But
because they call them, I mean, is a grizzly? I'm thinking, is a grizzly bear and a brown bear the same? I do think of bears as being like four main divisions. You got your panda bears, your grizzlies, your black bears, and then the little koala bears, and everything else is sort of an offshoot over those four.
Koala bears aren't really bears, so they don't count.
They're little mini bears.
I think are like a whole different line of animals, things too, like polars and blacks and browns.
Oh, sorry. Gosh, that's terrible. I forgot polar bears.
Yeah.
So they're one of your main division of bears. So what I'm saying is,
they just say brown bears. So I don't know if that's the same as a grizzly. I don't know. Senior scientists of the pod will correct us.
Okay. Yeah, please.
Senior scientists of the pod actually spent 3 summers in Alaska doing research.
Really?
And so he's very familiar with bears.
Yeah. I'm glad to say that I'm not familiar with bears, because again, in light of the first article, I would be traumatized by any kind of interaction between a bear and myself.
We've had a lot of deer in the backyard. They keep coming up to, or one of them keeps coming up to the bird feeder, trying to figure out if it can eat out of a bird feeder. It doesn't seem to be able to yet.
That's fine. I mean, that's great. But the deer is not going to attack me.
No. Well, I could. I mean,
but let me tell you that. I mean, that's interesting, though. Like you mentioned how the other member of your household is freaked out by spiders. How do you feel about snakes?
I don't think either one is a big fan. I don't know if it would get a freak out. I think, you know, something about insects and they're kind of different.
So what would your reaction be if a bear showed up in your yard?
I would make sure the doors were closed.
Would your heart be pounding? I'm putting you on the spot here. Me, I'm going to admit it. No, I'd be running for cover.
Black bears here, so I don't think it'd be too much of a problem.
I'd be trying to get into it.
I basically fed the deer. Like, I went out there with an apple, and he just stood there. He's like 5 feet from me, just hanging out.
Really?
Yes.
Well, yeah, because those domestic deers, they're the ones that spread all the Lyme disease.
Could be.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, there is the winner, 747. Did he have a name other than 747?
Yeah, yeah.
What did you say his name was?
Where'd it go? I lost it.
Like 747 was his nickname.
Oh, no, that's his full name. That's funny.
Yeah, well, with all due respect.
The other one said numbers and names, and this one was just 747. That's awfully anonymous. I was just about to say,
I'd like to think, obviously part of this competition is to, and I'm sure if you're actually in the competition, you've suddenly got continued pop-ups to donate to the right, game reserve right. or whatever. But yeah, I would think that now that he's a winner, can he get a name?
Just calling him 747. Unless he got the 747 to begin with, and they're like, oh, it's too perfect. It's like a big plane.
Yeah,
but they could at least call him Jumbo Jet or something like that.
Yeah, like, you know. But then again, you know, if he's called Jumbo, well, all the other bears are probably thinking that should be my nickname.
Yeah.
No, because, I mean, again, these are the it was a playoff between the 12 biggest bears. So there you go. There's your story. Right. There's your show for this week. Bears.
Yeah, slapdash effort.
Yeah. We put it all together, though, and hopefully you learned something along the way. So, again, we do have coming up, whenever you get your act together, we're going to do a Van Halen special. Then we're going to play some clips. And not myself. My partner is going to discuss the importance of Van Halen within the music oeuvre.
Right.
And again, I'm going to come at it.
If you haven't voted already, go vote.
Okay. All right. This has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice Podcast. Follow us on Twitter @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at Libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now, on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.